From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the co-star and director of the new film Marriage Story. We'll hear from Adam Driver about working with Noah Baumbach for the fourth time. And then Baumbach says he wanted to make the divorce process in his film as real as possible, so he had family law attorneys read his screenplay.
I would actually have the lawyers, in a sense, defend my fictional people. So I would say, like, okay, so what would happen if this person is up against, you know, if this person did this, what ammunition would you use?
And we'll meet the Mexican composer who's become a favorite with the LA Phil. All that coming up on The Frame. In Noah Baumbach's new film, Marriage Story, Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson play a husband and wife whose marriage is falling apart. It's not a spoiler, it's the opening scene in the film. Ahead of a screening of Marriage Story at the Telluride Film Festival this year and in front of a live audience, I spoke with Driver just after Martin Scorsese presented him with a career honor. Driver was at Telluride for Marriage Story and another upcoming movie, The Report, in which he plays a U.S. Senate investigator looking into the CIA's use of torture after 9/11. Driver explained what his relationships are like with directors he's worked with multiple times, and that list includes Jim Jarmusch and Marriage Story filmmaker Noah Baumbach.
There's just something that our way of working, our work ethic is similar, in that they don't take it for granted that we're making a movie. It has the potential to reach a place that is far away and either give language to a culture that's completely different than ours, and someone's paying a lot of money for us to be here right now for this amount of time to do this thing that will last forever. And, you know, we've labeled the feeling and how powerful that is. You know, why take that for granted? Why show up and kind of wing it, you know, or not consider what it is you're saying, and that no detail is too small. Now, obviously, there's traps in all of that, that you can get so worked up in details that you're trying to control everything and don't leave room for, you know, something that's more abstract. But with those people, they're brilliant writers and create a set, an environment on set where you're free to, you know, get all those things that you hope from people. You're free to get it wrong and you're free to explore. And but really don't take it for granted. If I was trying to summarize it, which is kind of hard, they very much curated the people that they want to work with in front and behind the camera. And you feel like, I mean, as much as everything is both has meaning and is meaningless, you know, we don't take it for granted. And finding people that have your same work ethic, that's a rare thing, I think. I just repeated myself three times.
No, you did not.
That's the best one.
Show of hands, how many people are in Telluride for the Adam Driver double feature, Marriage Story and The Report? Wow, okay, that's about half the house. I'm going to ask you a quick question without spoiling either film. I want to ask you about Dan Jones and the CIA's post 9/11 detention and interrogation program, which a lot of people would call torture. They called it extreme rendition and other things.
Right.
What would you say about that film going into it without giving it away, about why that movie spoke to you and why you thought it was something you wanted to do?
I mean, the topic was something that I, you know, embarrassingly didn't know anything about. And I mean, the original report is over 6,000 pages. The redacted version is just over 500, and our script was, you know, 130. How do you tell that story as economically as possible, but not without leaving the humanity out of it? So that all of those things just seemed an opportunity to potentially bring a topic to light that has been in the dark, and that I was inspired by that. You hope there's people like that in a room alone, mm-hmm. toiling away for 6 years, you know, with no support, you know, trying to make a difference. And that relationship with something that you've grown up with, thinking that you can trust, and suddenly, you know, you have to, not only do you feel like you're trying to make a moral judgment for the country, but internally as well. All those reasons why I liked and wanted to do it.
You were recently doing Burn This, and I'm wondering, when you're doing a play and then going into film or television, what are the things that you might miss but retain as an actor who's doing a show in front of a different audience every night when you're not able to replicate that on a film set?
Yeah, it's a totally different thing. It's Working with Noah, for example, he likes to do a lot of takes, and that actually feels more familiar to working on a play because, you know, the lines are the lines. There's no improv. This is what it is. You know, we're blocking it out, but the intention can be a million different things. And he structured the day smartly so we have enough time to explore all the possibilities of what it could be, not just arbitrarily, but I mean, sometimes, and then sometimes you have to rebel against him and just do it the way you want to do it, just to shock yourself and shock the system, and then maybe come up with something better. But, you know, it's like a whole run of a rehearsal, you know, truncated into a day, you know, which is, I think, rare with someone like Noah. And you're also rehearsing, you know, if you can, as much as you can before you start, just being prepared to give yourself time to explore all the options. And when you don't do that with, like, a Soderbergh, then I tend to have regret, you know, of like you can't help but go home and imagine, oh, I had all these ideas that now, but then again, maybe those were bad ideas that were just, so I don't know anything. This tribute is a sham.
Last question. I think there are a lot of things that different people will take away from Marriage Story. One being, if you're thinking about going into family law, you might reconsider it. But what was the thing that you treasure about making this film with Noah and Scarlett?
Again, that could be a long answer that I know I should keep short. I mean, this movie is hard to, I feel hard to talk about because it's very personal, and it was personal to all the people who made it collectively. And we talked about it, you know, a couple years before we started, you know, making it. And those conversations of what it's about or what were we trying to do are still happening, you know, but how love can transition and how that can be a violent, not physically violent, but an internal violent thing, you know, of you know someone kinetically where, you know, it's everything, your way you were in a room or where you are together is second nature, then suddenly to divorce that, you know, from yourself, that could be painful, but maybe it's just transitioning into something different. And I thought that was a beautiful idea.
This is not a sham, Adam. Thank you
so
much.
No. Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, the writer and director of Marriage Story, Noah Baumbach, on capturing the heartbreak of divorce. Our next guest is filmmaker Noah Baumbach. He wrote and directed indie darlings like Margot at the Wedding and The Squid and the Whale. His stories often feature realistic and flawed characters, and it holds true for his latest film, Marriage Story. Charlie and Nicole, played by Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, are a couple struggling with the early stages of their divorce. Baumbach painstakingly mapped out the process of their separation, and that makes watching Marriage Story, especially if you're married, a bit like watching a horror film. Here's how Baumbach described the movie when we recently spoke at the Middleburg Film Festival.
I have a friend who said, the movie gets divorced so you don't have to, which I think is a nice message for married couples.
It's relatively glib, but I can see it. Netflix has another movie that's playing at Middleburg called Two Popes. Your movie is called Marriage Story. They both seem like obvious titles, but almost inevitable. Did you play around with other things to call this?
Well, I didn't coordinate with Fernando Moraes. It was the working title from the beginning, with maybe the idea that I'd come up with something else, but like Susudio, you know, for Phil Collins. But something about the movie resisted more specific or poetic titles. Things like The Squid and the Whale didn't, there was no squid in the whale to be found. And so I kept coming back to it. I liked it as it's in its simplicity.
I want to ask you a little bit, because Adam Driver said that this was a collaborative process. And obviously you're the writer and the director, but how would you describe the process of putting this story together? And before you started filming, what you were talking to at least your actors about from the onset?
It was important for me to know who the actors were, at least some of the actors were in the movie. I wanted to have Charlie and Nicole in my head, both as inspiration, but also because I wanted to bring the actors in to the process a bit. Adam, I've been friends with now, and so when I brought him sort of some of these ideas, he would say like, oh, these are things I might, you know, he was interested in playing a theater director. That's, you know, as I remember it, that's how that came into the movie.
You have often had characters who are very articulate. They could be writers, they could be theater directors, they could be actors. They are very capable expressing themselves mm-hmm. and talking about maybe what they're feeling or what they're feeling about somebody else. Is that something that you think is a pattern that you like articulate characters who happen to have articulate jobs? Does one beget the other?
I don't know. I don't think about it like that quite. You know, the artistic, the fact that they were artists and creative and professional partners in this movie was, I thought, important and also narratively interesting because there was sort of more at stake, you know, even more at stake, I should say, in their breakup.
There's a moment in the film where Adam's character, I think it's the closing night of Scarlett's play, is still giving her notes, right? That mm-hmm. in some ways he is directing her when it doesn't even matter anymore.
Right. And also maybe important to point out it before he gives her the note, he's not going to do it, but she recognizes it in him. So she knows him so well. And so you're also revealing a kind of intimacy between the two characters because it's early on in the movie.
One of the things that really struck me, and I think it strikes other people about this film, is that when we think about relationships falling apart, there's often some horrific event or some betrayal or some scene. Mm-hmm. And this is not that. This is, you know, incremental. And it's not until the end of the film, there's nothing dramatic. But were you aware consciously of avoiding those big moments that we typically see in a relationship breakup story?
Yeah, it was important for me that there not be one reason or one breaking point, you know, that it's something that happens often, I think, invisibly, but also under your nose, you know. And you know, the movie also begins at they've already decided to break up. So if there were those sort of moments, they would have happened before the movie starts.
When you are having conversations with yourself, with people you're talking to for research, with your actors about relationships and about divorce, what are the kinds of questions that you want to ask other people? What kind of perspectives are you looking for? And how do those perspectives inform the movie you made?
Yeah, they informed a lot. And I often talk to friends of mine whose divorces I had been present for. I mean, I've been friends with them during their divorces. And what was interesting is in going back and kind of interviewing them in a more formalized way, they often revealed things that they hadn't revealed at the time. And I think because it's another thing about divorce is that there's often great shame that accompanies it. And people, I think, aren't often ready to talk about it all while it's happening and often don't want to think about it after it's over. So it was interesting to kind of jog people's memories and get back into some of these things and painful. And also to hear about how they were now and how they were able to work as parents, which is also a big part of the movie, with professionals, with lawyers and judges and evaluators and mediators I talked to. I actually often had them help with the story. I mean, I asked them like process
like
stuff.
Logistical. What would happen? How would this hearing go?
I would write myself into something and then call and say to, I would actually have the lawyers in a sense defend my fictional people. So I would say like, okay, so what would happen if this person was up against, you know, if this person did this, what ammunition would you use?
And that's a huge part of the story because at a certain point, without giving anything away, these characters lose control of their own narrative. Mm-hmm. Their story is told by someone else, and it's told in a way that is truthful to an extent, but is truthful in service of a greater goal, which is to have leverage and power.
Right.
And that it becomes a story of what you control and what you give up to get back what you want to control.
Right. No, that's a very good way to put it, is that they lose control of their own narrative. And they also lose their voices, in a sense. You know, the way we would shoot scenes often with the lawyers is we shot Adam and Scarlett's character as if they're having conversation, and we cut between their faces back and forth, but we're not hearing them. They're not saying anything. The lawyers are speaking. It's almost like either internal monologue or some kind of avatar experience of these people talking, and you know, and a very important part of the story, I should say, and also partly why I stuck with the title Marriage Story, going back to your first question, because there are, what is the marriage story, you know, and during the divorce, who has control of the narrative?
We're talking with Noah Baumbach about his new movie, Marriage Story. There's a phrase in journalism called gathering string, and that is you could be working on a story for months, maybe years, and you're getting a little nugget here, a little nugget there, and then you put it all together. Mm-hmm. And you said something earlier that I was struck by, that you had asked other friends of yours who had gone through divorce what happened. And I'm wondering, did you kind of intentionally or unintentionally were you gathering string for this film for a long time?
Yeah, it did feel that way. Because I took actual notes, but I think I took a lot of mental notes over the years. I mean, and also after I went through my own divorce, I was the child of divorce as well, and I made The Squid and the Whale, which is also has a marriage breaking up as well. And it's one of those ones where for years I knew not to start to write it. I felt like I had this movie in me, but I wasn't ready to do it.
What changed?
I don't know. It's sort of, I think, to your gathering string metaphor, it's suddenly something in you feels like you have enough. And so I felt like, now let's try it. And it could not have worked. I could have run into a dead end. But I think then, it was then really doing all the research I did, which helped me do it. And also, working, knowing I was going to work with these actors, and sort of finding this sort of expansive story that was kind of beyond me.
And yet it's not. This is a story about a marriage ending, but there's a lot of moments of kindness and compassion and humor.
I thought we should talk.
Okay. I don't know how to start.
When you're either shooting or in editorial, how do you figure out what that right balance is and how you make sure that it feels like you're not diminishing the stakes by making things not always as terrible as they could be?
There were a lot of hidden genres in the story, which I didn't even necessarily appreciate going into it. But as I was writing it, I started to discover that that it was sort of part thriller, part screwball comedy, part courtroom procedural. It's a love story. It's a musical at times. I mean, there's absurdity to having to serve legal papers to your husband. And I felt like, well, that's just there. So it really provided me many of these opportunities without having to dress it up one way or the other.
There's a song in the film, and I won't say where it happens, from Company, Being Alive.
Someone to crowd you with love, someone to force you to care, someone to make you come through, will always be there, as frightened as you of being alive.
At what point did you start thinking that that was a song that needed to be in your film?
Yeah, well, I half joke that I reverse engineered this entire movie just to put that song into it, or to have Adam sing that song. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, something that Adam and I had talked about actually for a while is how much we loved that musical. And I had it as I was writing the script as a kind of note on the side that I would, and as I was going, I also felt, well, then Scarlett should have a song as well. And it should be from the same musical. So it would provide very different narrative value to each character, but they're connected because they're from the same musical.
Noah, great to see you.
You too. Thank you.
Marriage Story is in select theaters today and December 6th on Netflix. Up next on The Frame, the little-known story of African slavery in Mexico comes to the concert stage.
It comes fine. Oh, I wish.
I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. The Los Angeles Philharmonic recently premiered a new work by the Mexican composer Gabriela Ortiz. The piece was inspired by the little-known story of African slavery in colonial-era Mexico and the abolitionist who fought for his people's freedom. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos has the story on Ortiz's history with the orchestra, which now includes four commissions.
There was not an empty seat at Disney Hall on a recent Sunday afternoon. The program was a sort of double bill: Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and a new work by Gabriela Ortiz called Yanga. The piece began to build slowly, but when the Tambuco percussion ensemble joined in, the music erupted into every corner of the hall. The working relationship between Ortiz and the LA Phil goes back two decades.
And then I received this commission, which is the fourth commission for the LA Phil and Gustavo Dudamel. And at the beginning, he requested me to write a piece that could be paired with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and will be part of these four concerts to celebrate the 100 years of the foundation of the orchestra.
Dudamel asked Ortiz to write a piece for choir and orchestra and sung in Spanish. Ortiz says she was a bit intimidated by the request.
Because, you know, being with Beethoven's Ninth is a huge thing. It's one of the most important pieces in 19th century. But on the other hand, of course, it was a wonderful opportunity.
Gabriel is one of the most talented composers in the world. Not only in Mexico, not only in our continent, in the world.
Gustavo Dudamel is the LA Phil's music and artistic director.
She has an ability to bring colors, to bring rhythm, harmonies that, you know, connect with you. That is something beautiful, something unique.
Ortiz started thinking about the themes that could be paired with Schiller's Ode to Joy, a poem that's part of the Ninth Symphony's fourth movement. She says she had long wanted to write an opera about Yanga, a liberator of slaves in colonial Mexico. She learned about Yanga through her husband, flutist Alejandro Esquer. He'd read the book Aztec by author Gary Jennings.
And immediately when he read the book, he said, you know, you must know about the story of Yanga. It's an amazing story.
Yanga was a prince from Gabon in West Africa. He was forcibly brought to Mexico as a slave in the 16th century. In 1570, Yanga, along with other slaves, managed to escape from the Spaniards and founded the first Maroon colony in the American continent. In the early 1600s, the Spanish colonial government organized a campaign against them to regain control, but failed. Finally, in 1618, the Spanish agreed to Yanga's terms and signed a treaty, granting his family the right of rule over the colony.
This desire of freedom that made Yanga to fight and risk his life and risk the life of his people is represented by a group of instruments which portray this strength, this volume.
Ricardo Gallardo is artistic director of Mexico's Tambuco Percussion Ensemble. Gallardo says for this piece, the group selected specific instrumentation.
Those instruments of Afro-American origin, and in combination with two or three instruments of African origin, because when these instruments arrive in this new continent, they got transformed.
Again, the LA Phil's Gustavo Dudamel.
This piece deserves to be played many times because it sends a beautiful message. It shows our culture, our blood, our rhythm as one America, and that beautiful connection and that beautiful message of libertad, of freedom.
The story of Yanga has to do with that, to be able to live within freedom and to respect the human rights. And also the text of Schiller talks about that, talks about fraternity, talks about equality.
Gabriela Ortiz says the ideals expressed in Schiller's Ode to Joy are as relevant today as the 400-year-old story of an abolitionist named Yanga. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that will do it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are, of course, at The Frame. And if you ever miss an episode of the show, you can always find it on our podcast feed. You can find us on platforms including Apple and Spotify. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.